situation. He gets the fullness of that which we believe the apostles measured out, meted out, in greater or less degree, to their own contemporaries. We know already from the New Testament there were some who were ordained episcopoi, others were ordained as presbyteroi, others were ordained as diakonoi. In other words, they could confer as much of this divine power which comes in virtue of the sacrament. You see what I'm getting at? There is a sacramentality in the episcopate, and in lesser degree in the presbyterate and the diaconate, but we're speaking of the fullness in the episcopate, which is built into the sacrament. And all that we've ever learned about the sacraments operating ex opere operato, which you know means in virtue of the rite itself, a direct encounter with Christ, as we're coming to talk nowadays. Christ confers the same kind of power on a man being ordained, let's use the word, ordained bishop, to make sure we don't miss the fact that it's the fullness of priesthood, is the fullness of that sacrament, which a priest receives only partially. That is, he doesn't get the fullness of it. What doesn't he get? He doesn't get the right to pass on the power to others. Plus, he doesn't get the right of jurisdiction, the right to command the people of God. And therefore, the authority is unique. There's nothing like it. The closest approximation is the anointing of David by Samuel. In other words, God, Yahweh, confers the power. Any observations? What? Sister, pardon me. It carries on through, this is the episcopal power, how does it carry on to the religious life? Well, it doesn't change in its essence. In other words, the inherent power which inheres in the person is possessed only by the bishops, with such qualifications as I mentioned before in their union with the Holy See. The inherent power, or the power is inherent in the consecration of a bishop. But inasmuch as the people of God need to be directed and governed in a variety of areas and enterprises and territories and functions, they then, under the mandate of the Holy See, delegate their authority. Now it depends then on the nature of the religious community. In a diocesan community, the delegation is pope, bishop, major superior in the religious community. In a papal community like yours and mine, the delegation is directly from the Holy See to the major superiors in that community, with, and I must add this, with such qualifications as were spelled out by the Second Vatican Council in his decree on the bishops. In other words, the fairly complete exemption which religious of papal jurisdiction enjoyed has been modified by the Second Vatican Council, but by no means, as some would like to have us believe, by no means abrogated. Indeed, religious life, as it has been known over the centuries, would go out of existence, because all the great religious orders, historically, those that are now in existence, are of papal jurisdiction. Does that help, sister? Now, consequently, it means that the person who possesses authority in a religious community, whether a major superior like a mother general, or for us, our father general, or a provincial, or a local superior, the power is not inherent in the person, but in the office. And the authority to, say, command, is inherent in the office. Now, the degree within which that authority may be exercised is determined by the one who delegates it. Thus, the Holy See delegates a certain amount of authority, more, by the way, for your discomfort, to the generals of religious orders of men than to the communities of women. I don't know why. I suppose mainly because of the variety of work that we have and the freedom that we have to have, for example, from episcopal jurisdiction, to exercise our work in a way that you would not, because of the nature of your work, have to possess. Then the delegation will be correspondingly passed on to others. And every higher authority determines the degree of the exercise of authority. The possession of authority comes from the office. The degree of its exercise, legitimate exercise, is always determined ultimately by the highest and proximately by the next to the highest authority over the one that possesses it. Does that help? This is a big subject, but at least I hope some clarification. Number 5. What relationship is there between home conditions and the current attitude toward authority in the church? In the home, the attitudes which will govern subsequent actions are formed. Oh, sisters, let's believe it. And by the way, if we believe it, as I trust we do, let's do everything in our power to do something about it. In two ways. In helping to shape and form the attitudes, especially of future mothers, but also of fathers, in whose hands so much of the future lies, and to do whatever you can to help present fathers and mothers to be aware of how much their attitudes have in shaping the judgment of their children. The roles of authority figures in the home are obscured. Yes, many reasons. This is part of the sociology of our day. My last figures, by the way, I suppose you've heard about this. Have you ever heard about the road maps of industry? Anybody? Road maps of industry? Well, it's a gratis. If you write for it, I think you need somebody to recommend you. If you need it, let me know. But the Road Maps of Industry is a monthly service that goes on for a lifetime, subsidized by I don't know whom, which give you statistics in economics, in social science, and so on. Every month, what's happening in our country statistically. Now, much of it might not be relevant, but some of it is very useful, up-to-date and accurate. Among the figures that I remember, my latest Road Maps of Industry, which I keep filed, is that the United States laboring force today is about 41% female. That is terrifying. And it's growing constantly. And I'm told by 1980, there will be more women working than men. You know all that implies. Then on the man's side, partly conditioned by the competition with women, partly because the wage scale is not geared to the ethics of a family. This, I never thought I would use this kind of words. The wage scale should be geared to the ethics of the family. So that if a family wants to bring 3, 4, or 5 children into the world, it should not be the responsibility of that lone human being, the husband and father, to rear these children. It's the duty of society. And when I read that in the Church in the Modern World of the Second Vatican Council, I said a prayer of thanks. Thank God we've got something to say it. This is a duty. You know what I'm trying to get across? Families have ethics, which are not to be imposed upon or created by our economy. At any rate, for all of these reasons and many others that I'm sure you know, the exercise of authority by an absentee mother and an absentee father, in some cases, is becoming nil. My most traumatic experience along that line was in Western Michigan. It's about 3 or so years ago. In my office at the university, I once received 3 visitors, father, mother, and a strapping youngster, a freshman in high school, 15 years old. It was a family problem, and the problem was the kid. He was insubordinate, disobedient, just plain nasty. What could they do? Well, they heard that I treat such problems kindly, and I do, partly because they teach me a lot and partly because I want to help. So I said, well, now what's wrong? The mother began to tell her story. It was all the father's fault. Then I thought the father would chime in, but no, the boy spoke up next. It was all the father's fault. Then the father, since he was also one of the three, he thought he should say something. So he opened his mouth and began to give his side of the story when the boy told him, shut up. And the father shut up. And the mother began again. Then the boy again. And the father tried again. He was told, I told you to shut up. The third time, the father by this time realized that he didn't have to explain what the problem was. The third time, and this is the literal truth, when the father began to talk, the boy was livid with anger. I told you to shut up. The father, realizing that he was being made a fool of, he continued talking. He was humiliated, as you can imagine, to the dust. He talked for about 2 minutes, at which point the boy kicked his father and told him, I told you to shut up. The father lapsed into silence. Where do you start? I discovered from the principal of the high school, the boy was not mentally unbalanced. The father was not mentally unbalanced, or the mother. But the father had simply abdicated all his authority, and the mother, marrying, as she discovered when I talked to her personally, she knew whom she was marrying, a mouse. And for 16 years, he behaved like one. At any rate, can you imagine that boy respecting the church's authority? And before I leave this number 5, let me point out, when we read a man like St. Paul in his letter to the Romans, pointing out how from the visible things of creation we come to the knowledge of the invisible God, beautiful. Well, among the things that God possesses, and among the attributes that are part of God, is his right to command his creatures to obey him, which is just another way of saying, among the attributes of God is his divine authority. Don't forget this, sisters. It has a very broad implication. It is quite impossible, except for a miracle of grace, for us ever to teach, I don't say the authority of the church, but the authority of God, unless we have the visible things of creation from which we rise to the knowledge of the invisible attributes of God. You know what I'm saying? It's not just his goodness and his beauty where sometimes we leave our exegesis. In fact, the trouble for some people, as I've discovered, is not their difficulty in recognizing the church's authority as coming from God, but in recognizing that God has any authority even to communicate that to the church. Honest. That's what some people mean by conscience. Cardinal Danielu says, the biggest problem he thinks in the church today is recognizing who God is and his rights over man. I don't want to leave this. Do you mind if we take a couple of minutes past four, Sister Christopher? Thank you. In lecturing as I do on Confucianism, and I'm not being exotic, by the way, when I bring these in. This is too much part of my circulatory system. I never fail to bring out what is most typical. Now, this is over 700 million people in China. They are in some way or other Confucian, which is a lot of people. Confucius was their great master. He taught way back in some 500 years B.C. that the only way you can train society to be obedient to its rulers is to teach filial piety to children from their birth. From their birth. That's 2,500 years before modern psychology. And he says, any society in which children have not learned from infancy to obey because they love and respect their parents. This is Confucius, the pagan. May God forgive us for using such words. Pagan. Any society in which children from infancy on are not trained to obey their parents because they respect and love them, that society cannot continue to exist. If Confucius is right, this is not a prophecy, that's a malediction. Right? Because he pointed out the deepest instinct in human nature, one you don't have to educate a child to, in fact, one with which he is born. Listen to this. This is Confucius. The deepest instinct in human nature is to have respect and devotion to the source of one's being. But that, he says, must be nurtured. And the parents must reflect what this child instinctively wants to respect, wants to love. I think the implications for us are fairly clear. I should add, by the way, last winter when I gave this lecture on Confucianism at the University of Ottawa, in my audience was a young priest who I didn't know. He hadn't got his doctorate yet. And he said, "I was so impressed by what you say. Do you suppose I could work in Confucian morality for my doctoral studies?" Well, I asked, "How much Chinese do you know?" "None." But he was so intrigued, as I mentioned him, what a difference it would have made for the future of Christianity if only the apostles had moved east. Well, of course, we would like to have had them move in both directions. Now, Hellenism is good. The Roman Empire with its Cicero was not too bad. You can see where my feelings lie. I should add, this priest, he is now at the University of Paris, and I don't know what he's going to do with it. I got a letter from him, and I think he's going to change the subject of his dissertation. But he is intrigued by Oriental morality. There's a lot to build on. The future of the church is in the East. Number 6. What are some practical guidelines for teaching obedience to Catholic students today? Let me first read what's here, and it does, in many ways, summarize what's in the other comments. Point out the positive significance of obedience and authority by helping students to see themselves as members of the mystical body whose head is Christ, the Son of God. In other words, that obedience is not something negative, even though it does de facto limit freedom. Sure it does. But why does it limit freedom? What kind of freedom does it limit? It limits individual, selfish freedom for the good of a society, which society is the mystical body of Christ. It's the kind of pain we're willing to undergo when we sit in a dentist's chair. There is a good for the whole, which we look forward to, and we patiently suffer pain in one part. Point out the necessity of obedience for the sake of principle, regardless of the personal characteristics of the one giving the directive. This is good. I'd say only a woman could put this down. We don't think this way. We've got our problems with obedience. Believe you me, but this is not one. As I distinguish obedience among women from obedience among men, I think there is such a, how shall I put it, not to say too much, there is such an awareness of the person whom I am supposed to obey, and a tendency, unwitting and unwilling, I'm quoting now, I speak as one less wise, but I'm told there is such a tendency to involve the person or the personality of the superior that if she is unappealing, it's harder for me to be obedient than if she were nice. And conversely, it's possible for me to be very obedient, but let superiors change, and all of a sudden something happened to my virtue. Well, no, it's just a different person. And consequently, that what we obey or whom we obey is ultimately Jesus Christ. Now, all men and women need this, but I think it bears some emphasis when speaking, for example, to girls for whom obedience may be more closely tied in with a person who commands. Point out that there is a difference between authority in the church and in all other societies. Oh, indeed. And one word before I leave this. That even though the A mistake may be made in the church, and mistakes are made in the church. Though I don't qualify anything I've said about the problems which even bishops now find in being obedient to the Holy See. And we better know what Rome teaches. At any rate, whatever mistakes may be made in obedience, we, generally speaking, don't make a mistake in being obedient. In other words, even if it is difficult for us to obey a person who may not be commanding the wisest precept in a given context, there is such a thing as expiatory obedience. And I can assure you, sisters, I have invoked this many times. In my case, four priests, somewhere way back, I decided that I would recite my office every day, besides other intentions, to help priests be obedient, and more specifically, to saying their office. I think by tying in some of the more difficult aspects of obedience, believing as we do that it is Christ who is sometimes commanding me hard things, that he knows best why, that by my humble obedience in something which I could maybe get out of or could make representations on, but I take, in order that by my patient and humble acceptance of what costs me, others and sisters never, I believe, and I think this is the second time I'm saying it in another context, in all the years of religious life, has there been more need for obtaining grace for religious men and women to be obedient. Apologies for the overtime. Thanks, sisters.